From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. John F. Kennedy was no King Arthur, but his life has often been compared to Camelot. This hour, we'll revisit Steve's bookshelf, a collection of books that have caught my eye recently. With the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination, the lens of history is focusing on the triumphs and failures of the Kennedy administration. We'll talk about two books that examine the former president's policies. Later, we'll step into the 1980s and get a taste of what life was like in the border town of Brownsville, Texas, for families trying to become real Americans. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Today, three books that I've already spent some time with and am eager to get back to. On this 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's death, we'll begin with two new books that look closely at Kennedy the man during the final 100 days of his presidency and Kennedy's team of advisors. That team was comprised of men including Robert Kennedy, Robert McNamara, and Dean Rusk, widely described as brilliant, but it also became a team full of sharp divisions. Later on, a conversation with one of this country's hottest new authors, Domingo Martinez, and his memoir about growing up in a Texas border town, straddling two cultures and feeling at home in neither. But first up, Thurston Clark's book, JFK's Last 100 Days. Thurston Clark has written 11 books, including three New York Times notable books. His Pearl Harbor Ghost was the basis of a CBS documentary. He's a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, and he joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Thurston, it's a pleasure. Good morning to you.
My pleasure, too. I'm glad to be here.
What fascinated me about your book and the way you opened it was Elaine de Kooning trying to paint Kennedy's portrait and the way you confront this elusive quality of Kennedy's. I mean, 50 years later, to what extent are we still trying to figure this man out?
Oh, I think we are. I think we are, and I think we're never going to completely figure him out. He was, as de Kooning found, and as a lot of his friends and advisors have said, someone who kept a lot of secrets, kept a lot to himself, and only revealed parts of himself to different people. He kind of compartmentalized his life. And that's what I tried to do in my book. I tried to look into all of these compartments to try to get as full a picture of Kennedy as possible. In other words, look into his private life and his political and Kennedy as a president and put them all together to get a more complete portrait, which is in a way what Elaine de Kooning was trying to do.
I was going to say, I mean, she sort of embodies this idea of trying to figure this man out. I mean, she was estranged from her husband, the famous abstract artist, and she had been commissioned to paint a portrait of Kennedy for our Truman Library here in Independence. This became such a monumental struggle for her. Describe that struggle to us, Thurston, and actually what she wound up doing to get it down.
Sure, I'd be glad to. You know, she went there to supposedly paint one portrait of Kennedy for the Truman Library, and she was chosen because she was known as the fastest brush in the East, someone who could capture the essence of a subject after a single sitting. And Kennedy was so restless that the people around him knew he'd never sit for a long for a portrait painter. So she arrives, sets up a studio in West Palm Beach, and discovers that his expressions, there's such a variety of expressions, his face looks differently at 1 minute to the next, and he's too complicated a man. She stays 4 days. She starts on a whole bunch of oils. She does a few dozen charcoals and watercolors. She takes them back to New York. She decides to herself, wait a minute, I've seen him in person, but everybody else, a lot of Americans see him on Life magazine, they see him on television. If I want to capture his essence, I've got to see him from all these perspectives. So she starts watching television. She starts looking at the magazines and drawing more portraits of him, more sketches, more oils. Finally, she's drawing nothing but Kennedy for the entire year. He obsessed her. She admitted to a friend that she'd fallen, quote, a teeny little bit in love with him. Well, as a lot of Americans fell in love with him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her obsession kind of mirrored the obsession, the growing obsession of the country with Kennedy that's continued to this day.
Well, Thurston, Elaine struggled. I'm wondering, how much did you struggle with trying to capture this guy?
I struggled a lot at first, but I found a couple of things. First of all, there's been a lot of new information that's been released in the last couple of years, specifically Kennedy's Oval Office tapes and Jackie Kennedy's oral history transcript that weren't available a few years ago. The Oval Office tapes are as close as we're ever going to get to Kennedy's memoirs. I think one of the reasons he taped people was that he wanted to have this material for his memoirs, and he wanted to write the greatest memoir since Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, probably greater. He didn't tape everything like Nixon. He had a button, and when something was happening that he thought was historically significant, he pressed that button. And these tapes have finally all been released by the Kennedy Library. They're fascinating. You listen to them, and you feel like you're in the room with Kennedy. So there was that new material that helped me. Jackie Kennedy's oral history was finally released that she did with Arthur Schlesinger. And several other important oral histories became public and papers, his best friend Lem Billings and so on. So I was working with some new material that I think made it slightly easier to look into all of Kennedy's compartments, and as I say in the book, to try to solve what I consider the great Kennedy mystery, which is not who shot him, but who he was when he was shot, and where he intended to lead us.
We're visiting with Thurston Clark about his new book, JFK's Last 100 Days. You argue, Thurston, that in these final 100 days of his life, that this was a man who was really coming together as a president, that he was hitting his stride in a sense. Why did you come to that conclusion, and what was happening at the time that brought him to that point?
Two things. First of all, I think he was hitting his stride because he was finally addressing the two great threats to our nation. One was the threat of nuclear war, which had become really obvious during the Cuban Missile Crisis when we had almost had a nuclear war. And the second was the racial conflict, the danger of a race war, of continuous racial conflict. And he addressed these both in speeches on two successive days in June 1963, American University speech. He announces he's suspending nuclear testing and wants to negotiate a test ban treaty in Moscow. That happened, and Kennedy had it ratified in October of 1963 by Congress. The next day, he announces he's sending a civil rights bill to Congress. So finally, Kennedy was addressing these two issues, particularly civil rights. He'd been faulted, and rightly so, by King and other leaders for not sending Congress a civil rights bill, but he felt it was time. And I think the demonstrations in Birmingham, the awful images on television of the police attacking demonstrators, moved him as they did the American people and made it easier to have for him to propose this bill and to send it to Congress.
You know, it strikes me there was another mystery that sort of lingered with him and has lingered over the years, and that's Vietnam. You're convinced that Kennedy was heading towards withdrawing all 16,000 military advisors that were over there during his presidency. And why are you so sure he was headed that way, Thurston? Because the Pentagon at the time was obviously pushing him in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, because the Pentagon had pushed him and his advisors had pushed him in the opposite direction throughout his presidency. The one thing he refused to do was to send combat units to Vietnam, which is what Johnson eventually did in 65. Again and again, McGeorge Bundy and all the people who would advise Johnson to send combat units had given Kennedy the same advice, and Kennedy had refused to listen to them and said no. Also, he had announced in October that he was withdrawing 1,000 advisors by the end of the year with a view towards having all the advisors out. He, again and again in my book, you can read the comments and statements he made to friends, to aides, about the fact that he was determined not to get involved by having Americans fight in Vietnam. One of the reasons was that he and his brother had visited Vietnam while the French were fighting the Viet Minh, the communists, in 1951, and had seen what a terrible catastrophe it was for the French. So Kennedy was determined not to let this happen to him. I've got a number. There are a number of things that I pulled together in the book that describe all of the different comments and all the different things he did. I think that the evidence is overwhelming that this was his intention. Now, as I say, intention is different from certainty about what he would have done. Talking about new information, in the last 20 years, McGeorge Bundy, Maxwell Taylor, who's the chairman of Joint Chiefs, and Robert McNamara have all, they've written memoirs and their oral histories are available. And again, they say that they do not believe that Kennedy would have put combat units into Vietnam.
You know, he had this incredible sort of almost innate skepticism of the military and those leaders, right?
Absolutely. That's the skepticism that he got during World War II. He wasn't a general. He was a kind of a junior officer, and he had the skepticism of the brass that a lot of junior officers had in that war. And this skepticism was reinforced by the Bay of Pigs disaster when he approved an operation to topple Castro that had been set into motion by Eisenhower. All of his advisors and all of the military told him it was going to succeed and advised going ahead. After that, he told one of his friends that he was not going to listen to the brass again, that he didn't think they knew what they were talking about.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. You're listening to an episode of Steve's Bookshelf. We're talking about three books today that just really struck me as terrific. We're currently visiting with Thurston Clark about his book, JFK's Last 100 Days. You're also convinced, Thurston, that Kennedy was pulling his personal life together and recommitting himself to his marriage at this time after years of philandering. Your book begins at this very emotional pivot point in the life of John F. Kennedy. What made you so sure that he was sort of getting his act together at that time?
Well, there are two strands of evidence. One is the testimony of a lot of the people, Arthur Schlesinger and other people who observed them together, who claimed that they had become closer. Of course, this could be, has been called into question because people say, oh, well, they just wanted to believe that things were getting better because of what happened, because of the assassination. But I found a couple of other testimonies that really reinforced this. One was Jackie Kennedy saying to a family friend, and this was reported to me, that just 3 weeks before Dallas, that she felt they were finally going to be a couple, and then she ended up by saying, I think I've won. There were instances of them holding hands in public, which they'd never done before. And there are other concrete things. Kennedy had decided he preferred Cape Cod to Newport, but he secretly had rented a house for a month in the summer of 1964 right next to Jackie's mother's and stepfather's house in Newport. He knew it would please her. He was trying to do things to make her happy, and it was a secret he was going to reveal to her after, I think, probably at Christmas. So there were a lot of things that happened, the concrete things that show them getting closer together, and she certainly believed that they were on the threshold of having a different kind of marriage. Whether that would have happened again, we don't know, of course, but certainly the signs were there.
One more piece of evidence that you point to was a visit to the White House of the great actress Marlene Dietrich in September of 63, just a couple of months before he dies. What happened there?
Well, what had happened there is revealing, because what had happened the year before, when Marlene Dietrich had arrived, he had seen her in the evening when Jackie was out of town, and they had had a fling. When she returned a year later, she came in the middle of the afternoon, sandwiched between two other meetings, and Jackie was out of town at the time, and he could have done the same thing if he'd wanted to. Aside from that, we have the testimony recently of one of the White House women working at the White House, wrote her memoirs a few years ago, in which she reports that after Patrick Kennedy's son's death, although she continued to travel in the presidential party and there was plenty of opportunity for Kennedy to try to bed her, there were no sexual relations at all after Patrick's death. she speculated that he had made some kind of pledge to himself as his son was dying.
Hmm. The famous March on Washington took place in late August that summer, again, 3 months before he dies. There's a scene,
right.
And I'm wondering, Thurston, if you would describe it to us, where Kennedy is standing before an open window watching the scene sort of unfold on the Mall, and he can hear the singing of We Shall Overcome.
Right.
Tell us about that
moment. And he at first hinted in a press conference that he was going to go because, having once opposed the march, now that he was that was happening, he was afraid that not enough people would come and it would make his civil rights bill. People would say, well, nobody wants the civil rights bill. So he was trying to pump it up. But then he decided he couldn't go in case there was some violence or in case there had been a speech that was inflammatory. So he had to stay in the White House. So he goes up onto the third floor with an African-American who works in the White House, a doorman named Preston Bruce. In his memoirs, Bruce has this wonderful scene of Kennedy and Bruce standing there, and Kennedy gripping the windowsill, his knuckles becoming white, and he says, oh, God, I wish I was out there with them. He can hear the strains of We Shall Overcome. And later, then he goes downstairs, and he listens to King's speech, hears it, and sees it on a television. And it's the first time he'd seen King give an entire speech, and he's incredibly impressed. A few minutes later, King comes to the White House.
Hmm. And what do they say to each other?
Well, King says, well, first of all, Kennedy says to one of his friends, Lee White, who recently passed away, who was one of his close advisors, he said, my God, that was a terrific speech. He said something like that. And then when King comes, Kennedy says to him, I have a dream. Kennedy's dream, of course, was slightly different than King's. King and the other leaders wanted an even more aggressive, more inclusive civil rights bill. Kennedy was dreaming of enough senators and congressmen to pass the civil rights bill in the first place. But they had the meeting again. Oh, the meeting was taped. Kennedy taped it, so we can hear the actual words, and I recommend listening to the tapes. It's wonderful history.
And Thurston, just briefly, Kennedy absolutely relished the idea of running against Barry Goldwater the next year, Barry Goldwater being the early frontrunner for the GOP nomination. He becomes the nominee. Why was he so eager to run against Barry Goldwater?
Because he knew Barry. He liked Barry. They were friends. But he thought Barry wasn't very smart, and he also thought that Barry was going to be very, very right-wing, and that the American people weren't going to buy it, particularly less than a year or so after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when everybody was terrified that we were going to have a nuclear war, which is, in fact, exactly how Johnson ran against him. Kennedy turned to a friend at one point and said, give me good old Barry, we won't have to leave the Oval Office.
That's called confidence, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Thurston Clark's new book, JFK's Last 100 Days. Thurston, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Bye.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to an episode of Steve's Bookshelf, some books I've spent some time with and want to spend some more time with. And over the years, I've enjoyed my visits with the historian Robert Dalek as much as any we've done on this program. He's one of the great chroniclers of modern presidents with books on Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Henry Kissinger, and John F. Kennedy. His latest book is Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, and it's an insider's look at the brain trust who made indelible contributions to the successes and failures of Kennedy's administration. We're talking about men, Dean Rusk, Robert Kennedy, Robert McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, Ted Sorensen, and Arthur Schlesinger. Together, they form what one aide called Kennedy's Ministry of Talent. Robert Dalek, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Kennedy was aiming for a team here that was full of exceptional people, the best and the brightest, if you will. What was he aiming for exactly?
Well, you know, he didn't know these people, except for his brother, Bobby, who he made Attorney General. But he wanted people who would be very smart, independent-minded, but he wanted people who would give him, at the end of the day, sensible, wise advice and have a keen political sense of what could be done both at home and abroad.
To what extent was this a well-oiled machine, you know, of men who worked seamlessly together with nary an argument between them?
Oh, not at all. they argued mightily, and of course, what they found was that they had crisis after crisis. And you know, Kennedy had a great wit, and the historian Arthur Schlesinger, who had written a book during the campaign about the Kennedy and Nixon, and Robert Kennedy, who was Arthur's friend, said to him, "So, Arthur, how would you like to be an ambassador?" And Schlesinger said, "No, Bobby, if I do anything, I'd like to be at the White House." A few days later, he saw the president-elect, and Kennedy said to him, "So, Arthur, I hear you're coming to the White House." And Schlesinger said, "I am." He said, "What will I be doing there?" And Kennedy said, "I don't know, Arthur. I don't even know what I'll be doing there, but that will both be busy more than 8 hours a day." Well, it spoke volumes about Kennedy's, not just his wit, his charm, but the extent to which he understood that you never know what's going to come and confront you when you become president. And, of course, this proved to be so true. You know, there are more documents in the Kennedy Library about Cuba than any other foreign policy issue. And it's astonishing because, you know, this little island, you have the Soviet Union, you have the struggle over Berlin, issues with China, Vietnam, and Cuba. Cuba just obsessed them. And they never could have predicted that. But he found that his advisors gave him a lot of lousy advice, certainly in the beginning when he was dealing with Cuba, and in particular the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he said afterwards, listening to these folks, mainly the CIA and the Joint Chiefs, he said, "How can I have been so stupid?" Because he was just so frustrated by the failure at the Bay of Pigs, and he became much more skeptical about listening to his advisors. He went to France not long after that, the Bay of Pigs. That was in April. And at the end of May, he was in France. He met with de Gaulle, and de Gaulle said to him, "Get the best advice you can, the smartest people you can find, but at the end of the day, you have to take your own counsel." And Kennedy remembered what Harry Truman said, "The buck stops here." He was the responsible authority.
That's a little unsettling, isn't it, that a president, you know, surrounds himself with, again, to borrow the phrase, the best and the brightest, and then you find out a few months into your administration that maybe these people aren't all they're cracked up to be.
Well, but he still considered them extraordinarily smart, but intelligence doesn't guarantee that you make the right decision or that you see the future in a clear, perceptive way. And so he learned on the job. I think one of his best features as president was to have see it as a learning experience. And, you know, we'd like to think, well, they come in fully armed to deal with anything that's going to come across their desk, but it simply isn't true.
You know, when we're talking about folks, Bob, like Rusk and Kennedy and McNamara and Bundy and Schlesinger, how much ego were we talking about there?
Oh, huge. You know, the one who seemed to be most passive and diffident toward the president was Dean Rusk, but even he resented the fact that Kennedy sort of saw him as the, Rusk himself put it, as sort of the local bartender who was amiable and ready always to conform to what the president wanted. But it was frustrating. And these guys were at each other's throats, particularly over Vietnam. They struggled over that. And there was, of course, Walt Rostow, who later became Johnson's national security advisor, Rostow wanted to bomb and invade or put all sorts of troops into Vietnam very early on in the Kennedy administration. Kennedy resisted. He didn't want to get deeply involved in a war in the jungles of Vietnam, but there was a lot of pressure on him to do it, and there was a real deep divide in the administration over how to go about dealing with that that problem.
We're visiting with historian Robert Dalek about his latest book, Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, and it's an insider's look at the brain trust who made all these contributions to the Kennedy administration. Do you buy our earlier guest, Thurston Clark, his contention that Kennedy was not going to involve the country more deeply in Vietnam? Bob, do you buy that too?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's strong evidence to show that, Kennedy, well, first of all, I would say we will never know what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he knew exactly what he was going to do either. But he didn't want to lose Vietnam because he was concerned about the domestic political implications that having lost China was a memory that burned in all the Democrats, and he didn't want to lose Vietnam. On the other hand, he was determined, as I see it, not to put massive numbers of ground troops in there. The Under Secretary of State, George Ball, said to him at one point, "Mr. President, you put 200,000-300,000 ground troops into those jungles of Vietnam. You'll never hear from them again." And he said to Ball, "George, you're crazy as hell," meaning, I think, you know, "I'm never going to do that." So yeah. I think it would have been a different result from what Johnson did, but exactly what Kennedy would have done, we'll never know.
Why did the president pick his brother to be his attorney general? Because you would think, at least on one level, that was taking quite a risk to, you know, reach inside his own family for such an important post.
Yeah, it clearly was. But, you know, he said to somebody, "I need somebody I can put my feet up with and talk to candidly," because he didn't know McNamara. He didn't know Rusk. Mm. He didn't know Mac Bundy. I mean, he knew them, but not in any close way. And, you know, the thing we've lost that we'll never recover are, I believe, the many conversations that Kennedy and his brother Bobby had. They weren't taped. There were no records made of them. But people could tell. At times, the president and Bobby would be in a meeting with a bunch of advisors, and Bobby would be tough as all get out, and he would come down like a ton of bricks on somebody or other, and the president would sit there clicking a pencil against his teeth and with a slight smile. And there are some who thought, well, Bobby is simply saying what what Kennedy himself would like to say, but he really can't. He doesn't want to sort of come down decisively. He wants to be above the battle. So he lets Bobby do the... this is not unusual. Remember, Eisenhower used Nixon as a sort of hatchet man.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Kennedy did with Bobby Kennedy.
How did the country react to the selection of Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General? And for that matter, how did the other cabinet members react to the pick?
Well, you know, the country, there was some talk about the fact that what the heck is he doing? He's putting his brother there as Attorney General. This is not a seasoned jurist or someone with an extraordinary background as an attorney. He was, of course, a lawyer, but and Kennedy joked and he said, "Well, I wanted to give Bobby a little practice learning about the law." You see, he would counter the criticism with humor, and you know that's what Reagan would do that too. See, the best of the politicians manage to turn aside the attacks on them with some very pointed humor. Anyway.
I haven't heard a lot of that humor lately, Bob.
Well,
it's missing these days.
Yes, it is missing, and would that we had some of it back. But, you know, we remember those lines in the debate when Reagan said to Jimmy Carter, he said to Mondale, he said, "You know, I'm not going to make an issue of your age and experience," because he knew Mondale was going to go after him for being old.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was shrewd, you know, but this is the way to handle it, because if you seem angry and, Richard Nixon sort of scolding the press and saying, "I am not a crook," and Well, that was the end of his presidency. People don't like that.
You know, of all the other members of John F. Kennedy's cabinet, who else did he sort of count on the most? I mean, after Bobby Kennedy, who was he sort of really high on?
Well, the one he came closest to, and he didn't know this would be the case, was McNamara, because he saw him as exceptionally smart. At first, you know, he didn't know McNamara at all, and he was president of the Ford Motor Company. They saw him as a rising star in the industrial world, but Kennedy had won that election of 60 by such a narrow margin, he felt he needed Republicans in his administration, and McNamara was a moderate Republican. Mac Bundy was a Republican. He kept J. Edgar Hoover on, Alan Dulles, who had been Eisenhower's head of the CIA. And this was all part of the domestic politics to try and create a kind of national coalition or bipartisan administration. So he was closest, I think, after Bobby to McNamara. He saw him as someone he enjoyed having around, enjoyed repartee with him, and valued his judgment. And McNamara was very good in the Cuban Missile Crisis, in that he was the one who held the line against the military, which was who were pressing Kennedy to bomb and invade. And McNamara was counseling that they try diplomacy first.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine today almost, but this idea that this White House, the Kennedy White House, spent so much time on foreign affairs was really sort of the way that administration played out. Domestic affairs, kind of a second tier to foreign affairs. Why was that, Bob? Why was there such a difference compared to what we see today?
Well, because foreign policy at the time, the Cold War, was at a kind of peak. And there was profound concern that we might end up in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And Kennedy said, you know, politics can unseat you, but foreign policy can kill you. Hmm. And I published out of this book an article in The Atlantic titled JFK Versus the Joint Chiefs. He was at war with them. Because they were so much more ready to consider using nuclear weapons in a possible conflict with the Soviets. And he was horrified by this. And at one point he said to someone, "I'd rather my kids be red than dead." And he never would have said that in public, of course. But he said it in private, and it was the measure of his fear that they'd get into a nuclear conflict. And so he reined in the military. Now, you also, one has to understand, these generals came out of World War II, and their attitude was, the way we won World War II was we bombed Hitler and the Japanese back to the Stone Age. And Stalin was just as bad, and the Soviets, if they steal a march on us, nuclear weapons, they won't hesitate to consider using them. So why should we be so hesitant? But when Kennedy learned of the nuclear war plan, part of it was to drop 170 nuclear or atomic and nuclear bombs on Moscow alone, and that would kill hundreds of millions of people in Russia, Eastern Europe, China. And after he had this briefing, when he walked out of the room with Dean Rusk, he said to him, "And we call ourselves the human race." He just, you know, he didn't want to be the president who went down in history as the one who used the nuclear weapon.
Yeah. Bottom line, Bob, you conclude that Kennedy's successes outweighed his failings. You're talking about the entire Kennedy administration.
Yes.
Because why?
Well, because, you see, I think at the end of the day, he made his greatest achievement was in reining in those nuclear weapons and getting that nuclear test ban treaty with Khrushchev, escaping from that potential nuclear war. And we know we came reasonably close from documents that are available to us now, both from the American and really the Soviet side. And this was, I think, his greatest achievement. Also, you see, if one thinks in terms of legacy, there was a poll a couple of years ago, Gallup poll, asking Americans to assess the last 9 presidents from Kennedy to George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy came out number one with an 85% approval rating.
Wow.
The only one within hailing distance of him was Reagan with 74%. And it speaks volumes, I think, about how people are still drawn to these two men.
Hmm.
The reason is they're not very keen on the Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter presidencies, or the two Bushes. And they want hope. They want the feeling that America has a better future. You know, the great historian Richard Hofstadter once wrote that America is the only country in history that believes it was born perfect and strives for improvement. Well,
maybe we've lost Robert Dalek here. His latest book, again, Kemmelitz Court, Inside the Kennedy White House, Insider's Look at the Brain Trust that Surrounded President John F. Kennedy. Always good to have historian Bob Dalek here with us. One more terrific book he's put out. Time for a break. When we come back, life in a Texas border town back in the 1980s. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's reviews of the latest indie, foreign, and documentary films showing on area screens, you can find them and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have a barking good time with animal behavior expert and veterinarian Wayne Hunhausen. We'll also hear with talk with award-winning portrait photographer Gregory Heisler, who's photographed Ali, Carl Lewis, Michael Bloomberg, and a whole bunch more very interesting people, often in very interesting settings. And now a very different topic, life in a Texas border town in the 1980s. Domingo Martinez has generated all kinds of attention for his memoir, The Boy Kings of Texas. In it, he describes a society where children are treated like commerce, physical altercations routinely solve problems, drugs are rampant, sex is often crude, and people depend on the family witch doctor for advice. One of our book doctors, Katie Stover, recommended this book to us. Domingo Martinez was a finalist for the 2013 National Book Award. His work has appeared on NPR and in many publications. He joins us now from his home in Seattle. And Domingo, such a pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Steve.
You know, this book has such an aura around it, and maybe that comes in part from the story of how you sold this book. Your agent had represented only like 5 books sent to her unsolicited in her more than 20 years as an agent. She said right away that she knew this book was special. I'm wondering how lucky you feel even now getting this book published to begin with.
It was a one in a million shot.
Yeah.
And I was kind of working the odds in my favor at that point, because I was ultimately just developed a random database from Googling agents in New York. And because I was a graphic designer, I was able to develop, you know, things like scripts and, you know, sort of purge email databases into Excel spreadsheets, and then sort of, and I basically spent like half my days at my day job pursuing this representation. And somewhere among the first 500 queries I sent out, Alice was included amongst them. And from there on out, it was just sort of this real comical exchange between her and I, because we just sort of wearily eyeing each other and not really certain, because she was one of the first people to respond. And in the end, my intuition was just telling me that, you know, this was the agent, this was her. And we sort of took it from there.
Did other agents respond to Domingo?
Eventually. The process, publishing, it's like an overnight phenomenon. I'm regarded as an overnight success that took 20 years kind of, get in the making. They don't cite, you know, the millions of hours that go into the actual, putting yourself in that position. But yeah, eventually, once Alice and I started our entanglement, we there would be sort of this lag of people, you know, checking their email and, you know, their spam folder where I'd, you know, be locked into, and I would pop up and see the material, and then they'd get interested. But by that point, it was like, you know, three weeks, 4 months too late.
Yeah. Well, you know, miracle number one strikes me as getting represented to begin with and getting the book published. And then miracle number two, the book and the sales of the book were flagging a bit until the National Book Award nomination came along. What kind of retro rocket boost did that give your book?
It was an absolute surprise. When that morning, my phone started buzzing at about 6 o'clock, 6 a.m. on the West Coast, and I was halfway awake. And
he says,
and
"Now,
my first thought, I was, you know, kind of opened a bleary eye and stared at my phone buzzing. And I was like, and I was, my first thought was, did I pay my rent? Yes. Is that my car paid? It's like they've never been this ambitious before in calling me at 6 a.m. You know, for my car payment. And so, eventually, you know, it was fairly insistent ringing, and it was Alice, my agent, and after that, it was a completely dramatic and, you know, life changing moment that I wasn't able to absorb fully for at least like a couple of months to understand what it was, you know, that meant, and then followed with, you know, the Diane Rehm show and all sorts of other performances and events. It was a whirlwind, and it was a shift that I don't think anybody could be prepared for. It's just it's such a tremendous excuse me. I'm sorry, I have a cold.
It happens.
A little beleaguered. But it was a total transition and sort of lifestyle and change. And from at that point on, I was able to, you know, leave my day job and actually commit fully to being an author. And immediately after that, we got sort of an indication from a big-time Hollywood producer that had some interest in the book also. And so that's helped quite a bit as well.
Well, hasn't Selma Hayek optioned this book for a film, Domingo? And if that's the case, who's going to play you in this book, in this movie?
I'm hoping Brad Pitt. You know,
of course. Everybody says that.
Yeah, he can get a haircut and, like, you know, get on his knees and short pants and waddle around a little bit. But it is Salma Hayek, and she developed interest in, interestingly enough, sort of on a parallel track to the National Book Awards. Those two things happened almost simultaneously, and independent of one another. We sent her her agency a copy of the book. And we're given instructions on, you know, how to approach it, and so we followed them to the letter. And it eventually got to her in France. And on a flight from France to Los Angeles, she picked up the book and read and decided that she was interested in it.
Wow!
So, and when she got here, we met. And so we're still in contract negotiations with them. I don't know how much I'm actually able to say, or if I was actually able to say that.
Okay. Well, Brownsville, Texas. Let's go to Brownsville, Texas. What kind of place was that to grow up in back in the 1980s? Because in the opening, you describe it as a place, as I said in the opening to our show today, where children are treated like commerce, physical altercations routinely solve problems, drugs are rampant, sex is often crude. I mean, wow. I mean, can you add much more to that description than that?
Absolutely. Ultimately, after publishing the book and even sort of in the process of writing it, I was able to, with the distance and, you know, the maturity, I was able to actually diagnose it a little bit better. And I realized that what we were dealing with was not exactly, it wasn't sort of it was a marginalized culture within a marginalized culture. For example, you have a very different lifestyle from south of Corpus Christi to the Rio Grande. It's kind of a no man's land. It's I think I I don't know if this part was eliminated in the book, but I kind of described it as sort of the scar tissue between either the First World and the Third World.
Wow.
And what tends to happen is sort of a little tide pool of culture. And so you have a tremendous amount of conflicts and decisions to sort of settle. I'm really blowing the articulation.
You're doing fine.
Ultimately, it's the internal conflicts are completely exhibited by your external circumstances and the fact that, you know, you're both American and a Mexican in the sense of, like, what, you know, whatever situation pops up, you sort of base your decision just to resolve that on, you know, what's easiest at the time. And so if it means going to Mexico to buy, you know, your groceries, your medication, you do that. If it means, you know, that it's something really serious and you don't trust the doctors in Mexico, you bite the bullet and go to America, you know, to a doctor in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have sort of this sort of cross legacy between the two. And what happens is that sort of leaks into, say, conflict resolution or, you know, situation, you know, really dire, you know, life choices, like, say, when you have a child and you can't afford to feed him. So and there's just this natural suspicion of government throughout the area also. Nevertheless, what I was trying to really determine later, again, through not so much the research, but just by going over the experiences and the memories, it was this stratification of the immigrant class and how there are hierarchies within that class also that I had never noticed while I was, you know, living within them or, you know, sort of swimming in that water. But now from the distance and from being out here and going back and diagnosing everything that of the stories and of the players and the consequences, it was really interesting to see just how much more of a class struggle that it was.
Yeah.
Instead of a race struggle.
Domingo Martinez is our guest. Again, he was a finalist for the 2013 National Book Award for his book, The Boy Kings of Texas. I want to talk about your family and your parents, particularly, Domingo. You're pretty blunt in the way you describe them in this book. Your dad was a drunken pot smuggler, obsessed with manhood. Your mother was a passive accomplice, and your grandmother was the pistol-packing tyrant. That's a mouthful, Domingo.
Yeah. They are no longer those representations of themselves that I depicted back then.
What happened?
Dad went sober, and he's complete. He's one of the only real characters in the book that never fully realized moves through a process of redemption. My mother, out of nowhere, shows herself to be this, like, this pillar of strength, this incredible titan of a woman, and divorces him and moves on and, like, strikes out on her own and has a completely different life in Houston, Texas now. And my grandmother, of course, you know, dementia and age and all the consequences of her bad choices sort of caught up to her. She's this tiny little person now and very feeble, very weak, and she's in the hospital as of yesterday. But, these were the mythologies that we grew up with, 25 years ago, and those were the interesting stories. My mother has not read the book.
I was just going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought I'd just throw that one out there. It's too painful for her. It's the memories are. She's too ashamed, and it's just much too painful for her. The book is also written at a level of literacy that is well beyond my father's capacity to understand. So he wouldn't get the humor and he wouldn't get the levity. He would read it, literally, and slowly. He wouldn't really quite get, what I was trying to put across with it. But at the same time, both of them, actually, the whole family is immensely grateful and proud that I was able to put down our family history in print.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it just strikes me as interesting and maybe not surprising in the least that we're talking to you this morning from Seattle, Washington, which is a whole world different from Brownsville, Texas, the Brownsville that you grew up in. I gather that wasn't any coincidence. Do I have that right?
You have that absolutely spot on. it wasn't exactly a dare that got me here, but it was close enough to it. My brother Dan had a friend who was stationed at Fort Lewis here outside of Tacoma. He moved out here on a lark because he was doing nothing, just kind of spinning his wheels in Texas. And then he invited me up and started to describe the area. And the thing is that we had no language for it, really, because it's like, ultimately, he just said, this is different. And eventually, you know, we'll fast forward, I won't beleaguer you with the bus journey, but there was a 4-day bus journey, and boy, was I smelled right. I smelled quite ripe when I got here. We had an apartment downtown, and there was no real way to ingest my surrounding. I didn't have the right vision to see what I was looking at. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense. But it took, seriously, a process of about 10 years easily for me to fully understand all the little intricacies in the culture up here, and you know the neighborhoods, and you know the way people interact, and everything. And the thing was, it was based upon the fact that I needed that distance. I needed
I was just going to say,
polarity.
How much did Seattle help you write the book?
It was instrumental.
Yeah,
not just the geographic distance, but the emotional distance, and that's the reason why I think I was able to be as brutal and as honest, as raw as people accuse me of being, because there was such a division between that other person and that other time and where I am now, and so it was that capacity of being able to, sort of sit here on my little perch and like look back down, into that part of my life and diagnose it from the safety of the distance.
Yeah.
I'm eternally grateful for Seattle and what it's done for me and how it's, and that safety and comfort of being able to look back on all that damage, pick it apart and safely,
Well, Domingo Martinez is the author of The Boy Kings of Texas. It's a National Book Award nominee, and congratulations on a terrific book, Domingo, and we'll look forward to visiting you with you when you come out with book number 2, okay?
That's due soon.
All right.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Domingo. Such a pleasure. You bet. Domingo Martinez, again, is the author of The Boy Kings of Texas. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have a barking good time with animal behavior expert and veterinarian Wayne Hunhausen. We'll also talk with an award-winning portrait photographer. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.